So this is our reading group, continuing our reading of Neo-Finalism. We're picking up from page 73 of the translation. So we're in the chapter Signification of Equipotentiality. And so I think we started this chapter last week, if I remember correctly. It's a relatively short chapter. And so this concept of equipotentiality is one of his sort of key concepts, which he's drawing from embryology primarily. So as we discussed throughout our reading, in early 20th century embryology, there was this discovery that in many cases you can, like, depends on the particular species that you're studying, but in many cases you can take an early embryo, at an early stage of development, and you can do all kinds of interventions on this embryo, cut it in half, or take a piece from the left side and swap it with a piece on the right side, et cetera, do all these things. And the outcome is like a more or less normal looking embryo. So like the ones where you cut it in half, you don't get half of the embryo develop into a left half of a tadpole or something. You just get two small tadpoles. And this kind of thing even happens, outside of a laboratory, just in actual biological operations, when identical twins in humans, for example, are a result of an embryo splitting early on, and then each of the sort of halves of this embryo develops into obviously a normal looking human, not like a left half or a top half of a human, and then again you can take the embryo maybe at a little bit later stage, and you can like once there's a sort of left and right division, and then you can take a section of that embryo that is from the left side and move it to the right, and then do the same thing from the right to the left, and instead of having like a left leg appear grow on the right side and vice versa, the piece that was a leg on the left is now a leg on the right. It forms a right leg. So it's sort of developing in accordance with where it now is rather than where it came from. And so this concept of equipotentiality sort of expresses the fact that this portion of the embryo is not sort of like predetermined to become a left leg. It has the potential to become, say, a left leg or a right leg. And then this sort of development... it sort of proceeds in a kind of like a cascade of like more and more determined properties of this region. So like at the very beginning, the embryo is more or less undifferentiated, and then it, different regions become sort of more specialized. Like you'll have like a left and right differentiation, a head and tail differentiation. And then, from left and right, then you might get left leg versus left arm, so each of these regions become sort of more and more specialized, and there's a kind of irreversibility in this cascade of determination, in the sense that once this region has sort of decided to become a leg, you might be able to swap it with the leg on the opposite side and get a normal, get the right leg side, but you can't necessarily swap it with an arm, for example. The leg arm differentiation might happen before the left leg versus right leg differentiation, for example. There's this sort of complicated, cascade of differentiation. But before one of these sort of branch points where this region decides that it's going to become an arm versus a leg, before that point, it has this equipotentiality, in the sense that it could become either an arm or a leg, depending on where it is situated in relation to the rest of the embryo. And as Angus points out in the chat here, we can sort of describe or we can make an analogy of the development of the embryo, this equipotentiality in development, with detours in sort of navigating a maze or, a real life landscape, that most of us have like a sort of largely sort of standard route that we use to get to, work or the grocery store or whatever places we have to go. But if for whatever reason you can't use that route, if there's, construction or, a traffic jam or whatever, you have to sort of improvise. Most of the time you can figure out, okay, now I can't take the the road that I usually use. So I have to, you know, go a different direction and then, you know, come back, you know, have to go north for a bit and then come back south or whatever. Yeah, so the sort of like detour still gets you to where you wanted to go, even though the route in between is different than it would normally be. And likewise with the embryo, I mean, normally the embryo in development doesn't have like this intervention that swaps the left and right sides. But if that does happen, it's still capable of developing into a sort of normal looking tadpole, assuming that this swapping happens early enough in the developmental process. Yeah, and so this concept comes from embryology, as I've been describing, but for Rie, it's sort of like he's sort of generalizing this concept to any kind of process in which there is this kind of semantic sensitivity, I guess you could, it's maybe not a very good way of describing it, but the sort of responsiveness to the realm of themes or forms and that he's talking about here. So the embryo develops towards a certain, you know, structure of a you know, a tadpole or whatever it is, regardless of the sort of disruptions of its normal process, in the same way as the person, you know, trying to get to the grocery store is sort of directed, you know, directs their actions in such a way as to reach the grocery store despite, you know, obstacles or unforeseen circumstances that come up along the way. And of course, these aren't, you know, sort of flawless or, you know, completely immune to any kind of disruption. There are, you know, interventions that are, you know, too great for the embryo to deal with, or, you know, if, you know, the whole city is like under martial law or whatever, you might not be able to get to the grocery store despite, you know, your best detour abilities. But anyway, yeah, there's a large extent to which you can, you know, adapt to unforeseen circumstances. And so this kind of adaptation to achieve a certain goal or to, you know, respond to a certain theme, despite, you know, different sort of contingent obstacles or unforeseen events, that's what he's sort of taking as like characteristic of this realm of true forms that responds to this, like, you know, these themes or values. Okay, so we can pick up from, oh, sorry, I lost where we were again. Yeah, so yeah, pick up from page 73 at these three facts, please.
Read. These three facts are perfectly equivalent. In each case, it is a matter of the passage from one domain of equipotential survey to another. One, either from one embryonic area to another. Two, or from the organic domain to the psychological domain, instinct, parentheses. Three, or from a mnemic sphere closed onto itself to the quote-unquote I consciousness. In the evolution of species, the nervous system is at the primitive stage very rudimentary, and it is rightly concluded that the psyche in the ordinary sense of the term, i.e. consciousness turned toward adaptation to the external world, must be equally rudimentary. Whether one is or is not a strict behaviorist, little matters here. Animal psychology finds that the development of behavior and of the psyche follows quite faithfully the development of the nervous system. But the common error consists in extrapolating rashly and in believing that where a nervous system is lacking, a consciousness must also be lacking. The second consciousness, i.e. turn toward the external world of an annelid or an echinoderm, must be undeniably more vague than that of a rat, a monkey, or a man. But if the absence of every nervous system corresponds to the absence of every secondary consciousness, it does not necessarily correspond to the absence of primary consciousness, which is tied directly to the organic form and not to the form of the nervous system. Nor does it further imply the vague character of this primary consciousness. If by going from man or chimpanzee to annelid, we go from a precise secondary consciousness to a vague consciousness, nothing allows us to assert that by moving from echinoderm to protozoan or to plant, we move to an even more vague consciousness, epsilon if not zero. On the contrary, the facts imply that we continue to find a consciousness of another kind, primary and perfectly clear and precise in its kind, albeit turned toward biological organization and not toward the world. An infant who has just been born has only a confused consciousness of the external world. This consciousness quickly takes shape as he ages. By retroactive extrapolation, we have a tendency to believe that before the moment of birth, this consciousness was non-existent or evanescent, and yet the embryo is capable of thematic behavior. It is therefore more logical to assume that the embryo had a consciousness of a different nature, with a different content, but as subtle and complex as its behavior can imply, which is saying a good deal. We do not know how to go about persuading our reader, if he had the patience to follow us, that we do not inject this thesis with any fantasy or any metaphorical vagueness. Like all half-truths, panpsychism has done more harm than good. It is panpsychism, more than behaviorism, that prevents us from defining primary organic consciousness clearly and precisely, because it quote-unquote fills the place with a secondary consciousness in the infinitesimal or diluted state. The harm can be traced back to Leibniz in his quote-unquote tiny perceptions. Understood in this sense, panpsychism is as false as the psychobiological order, in the psychobiological order, as would be in physiology a thesis that, having vaguely glimpsed the fact that assimilation and respiration are cellular and not merely macroorganic phenomena, concluded that there has to be in each cell tiny stomachs and tiny lungs. Whereupon biologists, failing to locate these tiny stomachs and lungs, would be tempted to deny every cellular assimilation and respiration. The facts of equipotentiality should set us once again on the right track. Equipotentiality is the objective functional aspect that a particular mode of reality assumes for an observer, a consciousness. That is, as we shall soon see, an absolute form, an absolute self-surveying domain. As the assembled and interconnected structures of a machine are the sign of a consciousness that was once applied to this assemblage and represent, so to speak, fossil finality, so equipotentiality is the sign of an actual consciousness. The adult equipped with a brain was at first an embryo without a neural plate. The embryo's primary consciousness is therefore primary from all points of view relative to the consciousness that is turned toward the world. The quote-unquote I consciousness as a domain derives from the domain of embryonic consciousness. If we want to grasp the facts, we have to become used to dissociating consciousness and brain into associating consciousness in organic form. The brain is not an instrument for becoming conscious, intelligent, inventive, or reminiscent. Consciousness, intelligence, invention, memory, and active finality are tied to the organic form in general. The brain's quote-unquote superiority, or its distinctive character, is that it is an incomplete organ, an always open network, which thus retains equipotentiality, the active embryonic consciousness, and applies it to the organization of the world. It remains for us to study more closely the content of the intimate relation between organic form and consciousness. For if we have noted how everything leads back to this close relation, which certainly contains one of the most pivotal secrets of finalist action, we have not yet tackled the problem in itself. So this relates to what we discussed in the last session, where he argued that organs themselves, human organs, have a kind of equipotentiality, and that equipotentiality is a kind of clear consciousness, I guess, of some kind. So that, you know, the heart has maybe what he's saying is that the heart shouldn't be understood as like a confused brain-like consciousness, but as a clear, heart-like consciousness, whatever that would be like. And that the same is true of embryonic primary consciousness, that it isn't a confused secondary consciousness, but a different modality, I guess, of primary consciousness. And that an interesting point he made here that kind of helped me understand what he means by equipotentiality is that equipotentiality is how a primary consciousness appears to another consciousness or an observer. So this sort of precise task-oriented action that can kind of overcome obstacles or distractions and reach its goal is the form that some primary consciousness takes for scientist or somebody else who's observing it.
Yeah, I think this passage that we just read is very important. There's like a lot of his sort of key concepts are brought together here. So maybe we started on that last point you brought up about the role of equipotentiality as sort of a sign, as he puts it, a sign of this sort of primary consciousness. So like one of the sort of recurring questions in like animal behavior studies in ethology is like, to what extent can we attribute to animals a sort of full or like high level directedness towards a goal, as opposed to a kind of like simplistic sort of response to a certain signal. So often, like, there are of course these, you know, classic, you know, rat navigation kind of experiments, like, can the rat figure out how to navigate this maze to get to the food source or whatever it is. There's like a million different variations on this experiment, and you're essentially trying to figure out, you know, is the rat just sort of like learning that, like, you know, this visual perception, you know, when I see this sort of arrangement of walls, then I turn left, and then when I see this other arrangement of walls, I turn right, and just sort of learning these like very simple cues, and then sort of using that, and then, you know, sort of those cues are just associated with the way the maze is set up, and then it is able to get to the food. You know, the results of a lot of these experiments show that the rat is not just sort of very directly responding to these visual cues or any other sort of sensory cues. It does actually sort of grasp to some extent the layout of the maze, and then if you make like, yeah, if you block the path that it usually takes, it is able to take a sort of rational detour that gets it to the food source in a different way. And it's precisely insofar as we attribute that rationality to the detour behavior, like if the rat just sort of, you know, finds its path blocked and then goes back to the starting point and sits there and waits, we would say, okay, the rat doesn't really understand the maze or the layout of the maze. Or if it, like, you know, found its path blocked and then just sort of randomly moved around in different directions until it, you know, eventually found just by chance the path to the food source, we would say, okay, that's not, it doesn't really understand the layout of the maze, it's just sort of happened to find the right way to get there. But when we can see that the actions of the rat to get around that obstacle are rational or are like effective at reaching the goal despite the obstacle, that's when we sort of attribute to the rat an understanding of the layout of the maze, as opposed to just like this very simplistic sort of response to sensory cues or just sort of like random exploration until it finds the right path. And this is sort of like a general, this isn't sort of restricted to, you know, rats navigating a maze, but in any, like in the case of the embryo, for example, we could imagine that, you know, the development of the embryo was a sort of like fixed mechanical program that, like, okay, this event sort of triggers the next event in the developmental process, and then like each one is sort of built into the previous one. But if this were the case, then, you know, taking the left section taking a section off the left part of the embryo and putting it on the right side, you know, should lead to that the former left embryo section developing into a left leg, even though it's now on the right side. And of course that's not what we observe. It, you know, of course, if you're doing that intervention early enough, as we discussed. And so the fact that the embryo is sort of responding rationally, if you want to put it that way, and, you know, making sure that the leg region develops into a right leg now that it's on the right side, as opposed to a left leg, which is where it came from. So this kind of like, you know, achieving a goal despite obstacles in a rational way is how we sort of attribute some kind of finality or goal directedness to that, to the developmental process of the embryo. And it's what we sort of take as the indication that the embryo is not just a sort of machine that is, you know, where each step is sort of built in, is sort of pre-built or pre-programmed in the previous step. And then the sort of step or the further, generalization that Rie is making here is that this is kind of, so in the case of the person or even the rat who it, you know, is capable of grasping the sort of layout of the world around them to reach the goal despite obstacles, we attribute this grasp to a kind of awareness or, an understanding of some kind. And he's saying, well, you know, if we attribute this understanding to the person and the rat, why would we not attribute this same understanding to the embryo that is, you know, doing something similar, not navigating a maze, of course, but, you know, navigating the sort of, configuration space or something of, you know, potential paths towards a tadpole. And, you know, when there's an obstacle to its, you know, normal path that it would take to becoming a tadpole, it is, you know, taking a sensible detour to produce a normal looking tadpole, despite, you know, the left and right leg regions being swapped. And so this sort of awareness or understanding that is, you know, capable of adjusting and achieving a goal despite obstacles, I think is sort of what he's describing here as primary consciousness. I'm not sure that's maybe the best term to use here. I think he's maybe making things more difficult for himself by sort of using the same word consciousness and then sort of qualifying it as primary versus secondary. So it's this grasp of, you know, how to respond appropriately to reach a certain goal despite obstacles. Like what are the possibilities? What is a better and a worse way to reach that goal despite, you know, given the layout of the world and the situation of that entity. And then he wants to sort of counter this sort of temptation, I guess, to treat primary consciousness as like a sort of lower grade or like a vaguer or more obscure version of secondary consciousness. So like when we use the word consciousness, we're thinking of, you know, the sort of I level consciousness where, you know, I as a person am aware of the world around me and to some extent of my own state, so I can feel in some obscure way like what my mood is, or whether I'm, you know, tired or energized, or you have a sort of sense of yourself as well as of the world around you, but this is a kind of secondary consciousness, because your awareness of yourself is not a sort of immediate awareness. You're sort of like when you're, I guess, assessing whether you're tired or not, you are sort of like almost sort of like stepping back from yourself and looking at yourself. Like you sort of look, okay, do I have this like burning feeling in my eyes? Like I feel like I need to close my eyes, and then you sort of use that as a sign of tiredness. So you're almost, it's almost the same. I mean, you're using different sort of sources of information, but you can also look at another person and assess whether they're tired. You can, you know, see the way they're behaving and so on, and say, okay, this person is tired. And you're doing something similar in relation to yourself, even though, of course, you have different sources of information, like the feeling in your eyes and whatever, but you're still sort of like using information to attribute a state to yourself rather than having that immediate grasp of that state. And of course, many of the states of our body are not things that we have very good awareness of. So like if you're assessing how drunk you are, that is not something that you're very good at doing, precisely because being drunk makes it harder for you to evaluate your own states. So you might feel like, oh, I'm you know, everything's fine. I'm actually, you know, better. My faculties are better than they are when I'm sober. But of course, that is not the case. So like your sort of capacity to assess your own state is a sort of secondary capacity that you're sort of using signs to infer what your state is, as opposed to, you know, your heart is not sort of inferring what its own states are. It just sort of has this immediate access to what it's doing. The temptation here is to sort of treat the heart's primary consciousness, or this sort of responsiveness of the heart to its capacities, is sort of to treat this as like a more obscure version of our own awareness of ourselves, at that eye level. Rie points out that there's really no reason to assume that this is the case. So like the fact that a heart is not aware of the same kinds of things as a person is aware, doesn't really give us any reason to like put them on sort of a scale of like clear versus obscure and say the heart must be lower on the scale than the person. Yeah, they're just doing different kinds of things, and there's no sort of good reason to assume that they sort of fit on a scale in that sense, and that one is sort of higher than the other. So this is why he's distinguishing what he's doing from panpsychism, because he takes panpsychism to be a position that would sort of attribute something like our secondary consciousness, so our sort of like grasp of ourselves at the person level, attributing this to other entities, but like in a lower degree or a more obscure form. And this is what he is denying. So this is not what he's doing. So he's attributing primary consciousness to all these other entities, but not, you know, just a sort of lesser degree of secondary consciousness.
Yeah, I think his contrast to panpsychism is important there, that he's commonly panpsychism kind of just dilutes consciousness to this vague entity that is used to kind of explain everything. And the key to his is that his consciousness is very specific, has that sense activity, that goal-directed work. And I think that that's the key, so that he can sort of ascribe it to a wider range of things than we commonly would. But not quite go to that panpsychic level. His consciousness is very specific. I mean, exactly as you have been saying, it's defined by its activity, its goal-directed work, that it has some value to which it works, and that it can adapt to potential barriers that may come along the way, to some degree. I think for me it's important here, because as I read a lot of this, I can see where at one point, had I read this maybe 10 or 15 years ago, where I would have just dismissed so much of what he's saying here. For instance, this embryonic activity, or when he talks about cellular respiration, and that we can't just put little tiny stomachs there, tiny lungs. And I would say, oh, well, you know, this is easy. This is the Krebs cycle. You know, I mean, we understand how the mitochondria works or something, you know. But then kind of, as he points out, that still leads to something of an infinite regress, because you still have to explain. I mean, if this is just an empty chemical chain reaction, that just happens for no reason, you know, it's just kind of like, oh, it was probably going to happen. You needed this, and you remove any goal directed or senseful activity to it. If you're really being honest about that, you still have to explain another level, and you get stuck in that infinite regress. Whereas with his, you know, kind of neo-finalist framing of all of this, you now can place it within that I don't know how quite to describe it, like a circular teleology. I don't know if that's the right term, but it's functioning for its own goals. Really, especially considering it like that, if you were to dismiss these, what he calls organic consciousness or embryonic consciousness, as just, you know, some genetic or chemical programming, you would also sort of have to dismiss what he calls here our I consciousness, our consciousness that's directed towards external environment, with the same way. And just say, well, it's just that. And some people might want to do that. But then if you do that, it's easy to get stuck in what he talks about as this kind of fossilized activity, because that doesn't allow for any creativity, any openness to activity. So there would be no kind of progression to anything. It would just get stuck and fossilized. So that's what I really take from this chapter, which this chapter for me was where this book really hits. And
yeah, he makes an interesting point in I think it might have been the last chapter about how if you try to sort of explain consciousness, you end up kind of explaining too much. Like if you say, oh, you know, this sort of arrangement of biochemical events, this hormone and this neurotransmitter and all these things happen, then you kind of, like, if you have an explanation of everything that's going on, like, you know, you have, like, I don't know, a biochemical explanation of a person writing a poem or whatever, then you sort of, like, it, then there's sort of, like, a unnecessary quality to the actual consciousness of the person involved in, you know, writing that poem. It's kind of what is it, the sound that the train is making, to sort of as an accompaniment of the train, but it doesn't have any, like, involvement in the actual sort of functioning of the train as a machine. So if you sort of, like, explain everything in terms of these sort of in this mechanical terms, in as a machine, even though of course it's a biochemical machine and not a sort of mechanical machine in the strict sense, if you explain everything, then you're sort of making consciousness into this epiphenomenon that just sort of, like, accompanies the biochemical machine and doesn't have any actual role in the process. And yeah, so it seems very strange to sort of suppose that, like, there are all these, you know, events going on, these physical events going on, and then just for no reason, for no, like, there's no actual role, but some of these events are also accompanied by this, like, I don't know what we call experience of those events. It seems like a very strange account of the world, that there's just this sort of, like, ghostly accompaniment to some of these events that has no actual role in those events themselves. You sort of, by trying to sort of explain these phenomena, you sort of explain too much. And then once you sort of recognize that, and then you sort of want to ensure that the sort of experiential aspect of, say, writing a poem is actually, you know, a part of the story of the causal explanation of the poem writing process, then there's no sort of, like, split or, you know, a line that you can draw in that poem writing process, and you can say, you know, this side of the line is the sort of consciousness side, where you have an eye that is, you know, responding to aesthetic values of, like, you know, what is a better poem and a worse poem, etc. And then this other side of the line is the, you know, potassium pumps inside the neurons that are, you know, doing these operations and whatever. It's this sort of biochemical side. And then somehow these two sides, you know, come together, you know, maybe in the pineal gland, if you're Descartes, and you know, bring about the poem writing process, that, you know, putting the actual words on paper or whatever. There's no sort of line you can draw in the middle of this process and say, you know, one side is this sort of goal directed, or, you know, directed to these themes or values, like, you know, a nice poem or a good poem or whatever. And then this other side is just this sort of machine side, this biochemical machine side. And then you have to sort of treat the whole process as at every level, or the whole poem writing process is this biochemical process that is at the same time directed towards values, and that has this sort of finalistic character. And so I think that's sort of, like, the sort of very high level, or, like, the big picture presentation of his sort of argument against this kind of split between the machine and the goal directedness. You can't sort of split the process into these two halves and then try to figure out how to put them together again afterwards.
Yeah, for me, I mean, it really boils down to where is the creative potential in your explanation, you know, and his provides that versus these other explanations. And then maybe someone would jump in and say, well, AI can be creative. Well, but who is the judge of this creativity? Like, what is creativity in AI? It's still a human activity, you know, as through the function of this machine. Yeah. Yeah. Really cool. Really cool chapter.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of connects back to the previous reading that we did, the cybernetics book from Rie. And of course, he's talking about very different technologies in the 1950s and in the 1960s than the kinds of things that we have today. But a lot of the sort of, I guess, questions about, you know, what exactly the technology is doing when it's sort of simulating or seemingly simulating a human, you know, problem-solving behavior. So the kinds of machines he was talking about were like, you know, machines that can recognize a letter, for example, in an image. And of course, this is, you know, much better now. We have pretty good optical character recognition software, although not, you know, it still makes a fair amount of mistakes, the ones that you get sort of built into PDF software. But yeah, it's still obviously much better than what was available in the 50s and 60s. And yeah, so the question is, like, should we treat this as sort of just a simulation of human sort of cognitive abilities? It is just sort of, you know, producing the same results, even though it's doing something very different. Or should we treat this as, you know, given that a machine is capable of doing this, using this, like, you know, sort of mechanical process in the very, you know, broad sense of mechanical, it's just sort of like a state that is proceeding to a second state based on a certain rule. Should we treat that as like evidence that the human capacity to, say, recognize letters is itself mechanical? It is, you know, something that is, you know, a state that is proceeding to a second state based on a rule or, you know, a set of constraints or whatever. Yeah. And so, of course, you know, there are, so he points out that there are processes that, you know, human cognitive abilities that we can sort of treat as mechanical. So, you know, our capacity to recognize letters is in some sense mechanical, but this precisely is the result of sort of building machines within ourselves. So like we, you know, when you sort of train a child to be able to recognize letters, that child sort of like builds a machine within themselves that is capable of learning letters, but there's still that equipotentiality in the sense that the child could have been trained to recognize some other set of shapes. Or, you know, to do various other things. And I mentioned, I think a few weeks ago, that like there's a sort of weird phenomenon in like neuroscience, in the sense that humans who, you know, have undergone that reading training, that like have learned how to read whatever the writing system that is in use in their area, in their sort of region where they grew up, regularly have, you know, one specific area that is sort of especially active when reading. And, you know, you could sort of like naively take this to be like evidence that there's a sort of reading module, that this region is like specialized for reading. But of course, we know that writing has only been around for, you know, 5,000-6,000 years or so. And this is far too short for the brain to have, you know, human brains to have evolved a reading, you know, a specialized reading region or something like that. So there, this region, presumably, you know, whatever properties this region has evolved for various other reasons, over, or it could even just be sort of like a evolutionary accident that it has these properties, you know, as a result of other regions specializing in other things, etc. But, you know, for whatever reason, humans developed in such a way that this region of the brain regularly has, you know, these properties. And then, you know, for many hundreds of thousands of years, this region was doing other things, presumably. And then at some point, someone, you know, it happened independently in different places, people, you know, developed systems of using visually recognizable marks as a way of sort of reflecting linguistic signs. And as a result of this invention or discovery or whatever, this region came to be sort of specialized for reading, but it clearly could have had this equipotentiality. It could have been used for various other purposes and presumably was long before writing was invented. So all this is to say that the sort of equipotentiality aspect is always there in a way that is prior to the sort of formation of these sort of internal machines, these cognitive machines that, like, so the child learns to recognize letters and to read words and so on, And then, you know, at the end of this process, the child has this sort of cognitive machine within themselves to recognize letters, which in some sense is similar to the optical character recognition machine that we can build our, you know, or get our computers to execute. But the equipotentiality that would sort of allow that child to, I don't know, learn some bizarre other system that no person has ever invented or thought of. That equipotentiality is something quite different from a machine that, you know, proceeds from one state to the next according to a rule.
Yeah, the point you made about equipotentiality being kind of the observable form of primary consciousness, it made me wonder whether Rouillet would, like, it seems like a consistent position would be to say that from the standpoint of an observer, equipotentiality can always be cashed out in more or less mechanistic terms, like in terms of physico-chemical interactions. And that, you know, it would just also be the case that for some forms, there's this other side that is an experience of the world. But yeah, I'm thinking now that Rouillet would maybe argue instead that the physico-chemical kind of step-by-step causality explanation can't fully explain things like detour behavior, for instance, and that, you know, it's because of the, well, the explanatory gap, I guess, can be a sign maybe that, you know, the object being studied is a primary consciousness rather than a machine, for instance.
Yeah, I think that's an important element to bring up, because I think, so he doesn't want to say that this primary consciousness is like an extra thing added on that sort of, you know, there would be certain things that are mechanical processes or these sort of processes that can be explained in these sort of straightforward physical terms, and then certain other processes have like an extra thing, this primary consciousness that's sort of added on that, because then you get to this bizarre problem of like, how does this primary consciousness interact with physical properties and sort of bring about you know, phenomena, you know, events that happen in the world. You're sort of still at that like pineal gland problem of like, you know, did the mitochondria have like a pineal gland where the mitochondria consciousness interacts with the, you know, ATP molecule or whatever. It's this bizarre kind of question, and yeah, it's probably a sign that something has gone wrong in the sort of explanation you're trying to give if you are sort of led to this problem of like, how do these sort of ghostly primary consciousnesses interact with the physical entities that you're sort of dealing with. So it's not the case that there are, you know, physical things going on, and then accompanying some of these physical things, there's this primary consciousness that somehow interacts with them and makes them do things that they wouldn't otherwise do. So what I think he's trying to get at here is that, maybe to back up a bit. So any of these phenomena that we do describe in terms of finalism, like the, you know, the embryo that regularly develops into the tadpole despite these disturbances, each of the sort of occurrences in this embryo are, of course, physical events that are, you know, brought about through physical causes, like there's always these, you know, chemicals in the embryo that sort of trigger certain events to happen in the developmental process and so on. But the sort of overall arrangement of all these different physical events and processes is not itself a physical event or process. And I think maybe here, like, this distinction between true forms and aggregates is useful here, because so a machine is essentially an aggregate that is arranged in accordance with some sort of finality. And so, like, in the cybernetics book, he talks about pipes. He sort of uses this term pipe in a very like abstract sense. And so, like, the sort of concrete sense of a pipe, of course, is that it's a tube that allows some sort of aggregate like water or, you know, sand or whatever it is to, or that ensures that the development of the through or the progression of this aggregate through time is restricted to a certain region of its configuration space. So like a bunch of water without a pipe would just sort of flow in all directions. Oh, sorry. Can you hear me now? On my end, it shows voice connected. It has like all green. Organelles, are you hearing me okay?
I hear you just fine, yeah.
Okay, so Angus, I think it might be on your end.
Yeah, it might be VPN.
Okay, yeah, sorry. Yeah, so this concept of a pipe essentially is like a constraining of the possible evolution through time of an aggregate. So you have like a tank full of water, and then you sort of like you imagine this like water tank is elevated, you know, it's up on a pool or whatever, and you pull the plug out at the bottom, the water is just going to pour out everywhere and probably make a big mess. If you instead have a tube, you know, that sort of you know, leads the you know, from the drain of the tank to, I don't know, another tank or whatever, or a swimming pool, whatever it is, and then you sort of remove this plug, then the water will not just pour out everywhere, but will be constrained by the tube to flow in a certain direction into the swimming pool, for example. And this is sort of like, for Rouillet, this is like the sort of general structure of a machine, is that you have these aggregates of molecules or atoms or electrons, whatever it is, that, you know, without sort of further structure would just sort of, you know, follow their own, you know, patterns of interaction and do whatever they would normally do. But then the machine, like building a machine is constraining the time evolution of these aggregates to follow a certain pattern that brings about, you know, a result of whatever kind. It could be, you know, a very simple thing like water going into the pool rather than dumping out on the ground. And yeah, so the sort of process through which the water is made to go from the tank into the pool is itself obviously a physical process. The pipe is, you know, a piece of, I don't know, PVC or whatever, that interacts with the water molecules in such a way that the water molecules flow down the pipe into the pool. This is all very, you know, straightforward physical processes, but of course the you know, building the water pouring machine is not something that just sort of spontaneously happens as a result of, you know, PVC like, I don't know, interacting with water and like, you know, sort of bringing about an arrangement in which the water flows down the tube into the pool. It's something that a person who has a goal in mind of, you know, filling the swimming pool has to sort of decide to put the pipe in the right orientation that will make the water flow in that way. And so the person is sort of, you know, responding to some sort of value of like, I don't know, I want to have water in my swimming pool so I can swim. And is also sort of aware of the properties of water and pipes and so on, and uses that awareness to achieve a goal. In the case of the embryo, of course, the embryo is not, you know, aware in the sense of, you know, in the same way a human is not aware of, say, the properties of its own, you know, chemical constituents and so on. It's not sort of like deciding in that sense of I'm going to use my left leg formation region as a right leg formation region after this intervention. But it's doing something analogous to that sort of process in the sense that it is sort of making all the sort of constituent molecules that make up that embryo. It's using those molecules. It's directing their time evolution in such a way that it results in the formation of a right leg. And so, yeah, so a machine is this kind of constraining of the time evolution of other entities in such a way as to bring about a goal. But that set of constraints is not itself, the arrangement of those constraints is not itself a physical entity that is sort of you know, making the system as a whole sort of adopt a certain arrangement. It's not the PVC pipe and the water tank that are sort of making themselves take on the arrangement of, you know, putting the water in the pool.
Yeah, I know. I know this is where the book is going, but as I'm listening to everything, I'm always thinking, okay, well, you know, if I was being my most skeptical, what would I be saying? And you know, just being kind of a jackass skeptic, you might just say, I mean, like, the criticism could just fall at the level of just basic cause and effect and all of this, you know, this step-by-step cause and effect, which he'll go on to show that this is all happening, maybe not within that particular cause-effect spatio-temporal realm. So for me, what I have to keep in mind is that his concept here, this that what we're calling consciousness right now, I guess, which again that term is so loaded, but equipotentiality, all of these things, that it's functioning within this broader what he calls sense, SENS framework. You know, I don't know, I just to kind of keep it grounded within that concept of his.
Yeah, there's a helpful sort of ambiguity of the word sens in French here, because it means, yeah, sense, in the way that we, you know, in English we would say that, you know, this makes sense, or, you know, the sense of this word is X. And it also means direction, you know, in the sense of, like, you know, heading north, it is a certain direction. And so I think he's going to, like, he's kind of playing on that ambiguity, because he's treating meaningfulness as a kind of, you know, direction in, like, a space of meaning, if you want to put it in those terms. So, like, the embryo is you know, directed toward, you know, has a direction in the sort of overall, I don't know, configuration space of, you know, what the embryo could do. It is sort of selecting a direction that leads towards this, you know, normal looking tadpole. And this is, you know, at the same time, a kind of meaningfulness of what it's doing, rather than a very mechanical sort of one state being produced by a previous state. So yeah, it's the ambiguity is in French, or the fact that this word sens has a broader meaning or different meanings than the English word sense. You know, it's helpful for his point about, you know, equipotentiality here. And then maybe even a third meaning. I mean, they're all sort of related, but sens, like sense in English, we also use the word sens for, like, the sense of smell, or the sense of vision, whatever. So also the embryo is, you know, it has senses in that sense, not in the way that, and, you know, the embryo is not sort of like looking at a blueprint that says, you know, here's what a tadpole looks like. But it is sort of aiming at the tadpole, the sort of tadpole design or form or whatever. It is still sort of responsive to that tadpole design, something in something like a way that we can sort of picture it, like, you know, looking at a goal and trying to reach that goal. But of course, yeah, the danger here is to sort of, like, yeah, imagine that the embryo has a sort of blueprint in front of it that it's looking at, and then, you know, sort of comparing itself to and saying, oh, I should have a right leg here instead of a left leg, which of course is not anything like what is actually happening. But yeah, you can, before we started recording, I mentioned briefly the Plotinus's Ennead about contemplation and nature. And so he's talking about how, you know, natural entities, you know, like a tadpole or whatever, are contemplations, as opposed to having contemplation. So the tadpole is not sort of, you know, contemplating the one, but it is a contemplation of the one. And so likewise, you could say that the embryo here for Rouillet is not sort of contemplating the tadpole. It's not looking at a tadpole blueprint and saying, you know, here's what a tadpole looks like. But it is, in some sense, a directedness towards the tadpole. It's as if it's sort of like contemplating the tadpole form, or sorry, it is a contemplation of the tadpole form, as opposed to sort of being outside that tadpole form and looking at that tadpole form and sort of using that representation of the tadpole as a blueprint that it works off of. So yeah, it's sense in a third sort of meaning of that word, in the sense of like perception, or here contemplation. So the tadpole, this true form, is a contemplation of itself. It's this sort of absolute survey of itself. And it's also this directedness through the configuration space of everything that the embryo could do. And it's also meaning. So all these different meanings of sens are all at work at the same time. So we've spent a long time on this one passage, but I think it's an important passage because it sort of brings together a lot of these different points that he's been, coming at it from different angles throughout the book. So we are at a chapter break. I don't know if we want to go on to the next chapter here at this point or stop here for today. What do both of you think?
This next chapter, it also starts starts off running. I mean, there's not a really good stopping point early on, in my opinion. Maybe we could preview it a little bit, or I don't know, or we could read the very first part and leave it hanging for next week. I don't know. I'm open.
Yeah, Angus, what do you think?
Yeah, maybe we could read just the first page or so of the next chapter, before he goes into this list of different consciousness observer couplings.
Sure. Okay. Organelles, do you want to read the first page up till the letter A, subheading or itemized list?
Sure.
I guess. Thanks.
Sure. Sounds good. This last paragraph ends with a bit of a banger here too, so this is good. Okay. So chapter 8. The reciprocal illusion of incarnation and quote unquote material existence. The examination of the facts forces us to rethink the Cartesian break between a thinking soul and a mechanical body. The opposition, as it emerges from recent observations and experiments, is instead between 1. The organism as a set of tools or a set of organs insofar as they are tools, and 2. Consciousness. Primary or secondary, organic or cerebral, that assembles multiple elements in such a way as to turn them into quote-unquote ambosceptors in a causal chain and that thematically oversees the operation of organic machines, regulates them in case of lesion or failure, and thus gives to organic structures the property of equipotentiality. This dualism, as different as it may be from the Cartesian variety, is still a dualism and seems to pose the same problem that tormented Descartes' successors. How can two types of existence, as heterogeneous as consciousness and the body, be ultimately joined together in the unity of the living being? Up to now, we took it upon ourselves to pass ceaselessly from the perspective of consciousness and the subject to the perspective of the body and the object. We have to justify these passages by rediscovering unity, or a certain unity. It often happens in the history of the sciences that a problem that at one point appeared insoluble seems to solve itself. Such is the case here. The solution was discovered several decades ago by many authors, and we attempted to formulate it precisely in an earlier text. He refers to his book La Conscience et le Corps, 1937. Hymens, whose metaphysical works we will set aside, had expanded it with perfect clarity in various articles. These are gathered in Gesammelt Kleinere Schriften, 1927. But he committed a gross error that we will come back to. On the other hand, in the particular domain of psychiatry, Adolf Meyer had protested for a long time against the abrupt distinction between body and mind, somatic theories and psychological theories in mental medicine, and called for psychosomatic medicine. This solution can be formulated in a few words. The problem posed by the duality of consciousness and the body, consciousness organism, and body organism, is illusory for the excellent reason that there is no body. The quote-unquote body is the byproduct of the perception of a being by another being. The perceived being is perceived by definition as an object in the etymological sense of the term. It appears as independent of the observer And this leads him to substantialize it.
Now recording.
Not hearing you. Yeah, I think there's a connection issue. I don't know what exactly happened. Can you try again now? Yeah, you cut out. Yeah, not hearing you now either.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, yeah, so I think it's just organelles that there's a connection issue.